I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Paul Gamblin. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks very much, Michael.
Paul, you have been mixed up in all sorts of what we might call conservation environmental campaigning over the years. You're currently the director of the Protect Ningaloo campaign, am I right?
That's correct, yes. It's hosted by the Australian Marine Conservation Society, which is Australia's biggest national oceans-focused conservation organisation.
Well, I saw you quite recently at the Frio social event when Ningaloo was being promoted. You introduced Tim Winton before a huge crowd. Ningaloo really does excite people's imagination, doesn't it?
It does. It does. I think it's for people who have been there and experienced it directly. It has an indelible kind of profound impact. I know that from my first experiences of the place, and it still has that impact on me. But I think for many people, even those who don't go there, it's the idea of places like Ningaloo, which really reaches people. It's the sense that there is this wonder and complexity that is inspirational and kind of mysterious and all of those things. And so, yeah, we were very pleased with the turnout. We've always had great turnouts to events. And of course, Tim is a major draw card for those kinds of things too.
This is Tim Winton.
Tim Winton, yes.
AO.
That's right, just as of the last few days, exactly. Order of Australia.
Shout out to Tim, congratulations.
Exactly, very well deserved.
But it's about 10 or a dozen years ago that you personally were battling, campaigning to save Ningaloo.
Even longer, actually, yeah. even longer, the early 2000s. There was a campaign that, and Tim was involved in that one as well, where we campaigned to stop what we considered to be anachronistic, inappropriate tourism development just near Coral Bay, big marina resort and housing development. And we campaigned then to stop that, but also to try and instill a different kind of approach from government, a more scientifically based, more holistic approach to managing the whole Ningaloo area. And we were able to stop that, the resort. Jeff Gallop deserves credit, his government deserves credit for that, but also for increasing the size of the marine park and the levels of protection to globally, to help set a new global benchmark really for that. And then National Heritage Listing and then World Heritage Listing as well, which was great. But we didn't quite finish the job as far as we were concerned, and now we're back trying to finish the job.
I got myself mixed up with those years. I think of 2011, but in fact it was 2001-2, as you say, for the early Ningaloo, and some famous vision of that video. Just mentioned Jeff Gallop proudly bringing in the protections. But you were an even younger man then, Paul. How did you get mixed up in the original Ningaloo campaign?
Yeah, well, I mean, a combination of things. One is that I was lucky enough to travel. My parents are pretty outdoorsy and up for adventures, and first traveled there in the 80s, actually, and then in the 90s, first with my dad and my brother, who's a zoologist, and then with the whole family in the 90s, and also I was a volunteer turtle researcher along the Ningaloo coast and one of the islands, uninhabited islands off there, again, with my brother. Which had a really significant impact on me. It really, really gave me a deep love for that part of the world and the creatures that live there. So the motivation was there to look after the place, but I didn't have any experience in campaigning. I wasn't involved in anything until I got involved in the campaign to protect the Leighton Beach area near Fremantle. And it was the consequence of that campaign, and we were able to be successful in that campaign, where I learned a lot. Where when I heard that there were problems at Ningaloo, I just picked up the phone and said, I've just had some campaigning experience, love Ningaloo, I'm very happy to help and volunteer to help if you need it, and one thing led to another.
We'll come back to Port Beach. Staying with Ningaloo and your own background, you mentioned a zoological brother. What about yourself? Did you bring marine science or the like?
Great interest in nature and the outdoors, but no, my background is in the social sciences, in commerce, and that's what I studied at honours and that, and did some postgraduate research and taught in that arena, and corporate strategy and that kind of thing, actually, figuring that no matter what I did in life, that kind of background would be useful, and I think it actually has, that background and analysis and strategy and research and writing and all of those kinds of things have been very helpful.
So after the successful Nindaloo campaign, where did your career take you?
So I joined WWF Australia towards the end of the initial campaign, and then ended up working in a whole range of very interesting areas, the Kimberley in particular. I was working to try and protect offshore islands and atolls and reefs like Scott Reef from liquefied natural gas development, from processing plants that were going to be located in some of those areas. And also just generally to try and get the Kimberley onto the right track in terms of long overdue protections, which largely has happened. And I was part of a collaboration with lots of other people and groups, and with the Kimberley Land Council and others. And then worked to protect areas of the wheat belt with a great team in Western Australia. I was privileged to lead the Western Australian team to do that kind of work as well. And then nationally got involved in creating with others, many others, the national network of marine protected areas around Australia, and then got involved in similar work to try and build the case for protection of Antarctica as well. So it was amazing. And then work in the Coral Triangle through Indonesia and the Pacific. Very privileged, very, very interesting and rewarding work.
And it seems at least through that period of time that oceans, marine areas were offshore, were the important ones for you.
I think, yeah, marine and coastal issues have always been very special to me and important. But I'm interested in conservation generally, and did quite a lot of work and have done quite a lot of work on climate change as well and policy. And the international work was interesting. The more international work I did, the more interested I became in that. And then I ended up leaving.
Then you ended up in World Wildlife Foundation, WWF internationally.
International, yeah, which is a really interesting experience as well. To look at the biggest picture of all, from a planetary perspective, working on oceans globally and climate issues and related issues, and also development issues too.
So, where did you move to? What sorts of people are dealing with? How big, if you like, is the establishment? And what's then the network of organisations around the planet?
It's certainly different from working nationally. And there are pros and cons, I think, at working at all these different levels, from the very local to the global. I was working out of Australia, but also out of Switzerland, where WWF International has its headquarters. And working there, I think, in many ways was an incredibly valuable experience, and in ways that I'm still, I think, processing. Being able to see the world through a different lens, and what we were trying to do then was to wake leaders up, those who weren't already awakened, to the importance of ocean and coastal conservation. And so we were having to make some quite pragmatic arguments. So, for example, I worked with the Boston Consulting Group, that was a partner of WWF, to determine that the ocean is the world's seventh largest economy. So we're trying to make the economic case for conservation, because there just wasn't enough action as far as we were concerned. And we're looking at things like food security, people who are already struggling to survive along the coastal regions of the earth, coastal East Africa, for example, and Melanesia, wherever it happened to be, to make the case that conserving the ocean created this enormous opportunity to help people survive and prosper. So it was about livelihoods, food security. Biodiversity was important, but it was only one of the arguments. And at that level, it can only be one of the arguments. There have to be a whole lot of others that you deploy. So that was a really interesting experience.
When I was a kid, the idea that in a sense a voluntary NGO like WWF or any of the conservation groups might become significant players in the world conservation movement would be something we wouldn't have even thought about. We might have thought of a United Nations group being involved, but
yeah.
How did it happen for the WWF?
So these organisations now are big non-government organisations, so they have structures and approaches that are similar to other organisations as well. So they're not voluntary. There are voluntary roles in them, but for the most part they're not. And they are very influential. Actually, WWF is the biggest in the world, and so it was interesting to work for at that level to see the kind of opportunity and access that you sometimes have at global conferences, UN conferences, and things like that when you work for WWF.
When I said voluntary, I sort of put a footnote to that, in the sense that you weren't a governmental body, you didn't come out of the UN, but you've imposed yourself in that sense on world decision making. How did that come about, do you think?
I think it's a multi-decadal history there, of course, around how civil society has occupied what to some extent has been a vacuum to support policy to build policy and momentum around policy that wouldn't otherwise happen. So it's quite a complementary sector to what the likes of the UN, other intergovernmental bodies do. It's hard work. The UN and others have, as we know, a very difficult challenge much of the time. And so civil society organisations can actually help across sectors. The Red Cross and others do work in other sectors, Oxfam too, to help achieve goals that would otherwise be unreachable.
Paul, I look at your notional CV as we talk, and I think to myself, you must have spent about the last 20 years, one way and the other, here and there, with WWF. Is that about right?
And in the last four or so years with the Australian Marine Conservation Society, but yeah, mostly with WWF and WWF International, and before that I lived in the US for a few years as well. So I've been very fortunate to live in different places, which has given me a richness of experience. I certainly am very, very grateful to have.
And when you finish with WWF and you're back here, as you say, with the Australian Marine Conservation Society, and particularly protecting Ningaloo, what was that, if you like, skill set that you brought back? What had you learned, and did Australia sort of feel like a slightly foreign place when you re-engaged?
In a way, I hope I can bring some useful skills to these things, but much of it is about recognising where you have gaps in knowledge and skills and knowing who to work with. And it is very collaborative, and I love that about the work that I do. It's I've made lifelong friends right from the Leighton days in the late 90s through till now in Ningaloo as well. And work with some fantastic people, including some of the world's best scientists as well, which is a real privilege. It's different. Working in Australia is different from working internationally. I think I was ready. I'd done about 6 years, 5 or 6 years of working internationally, really intensively, and I might go back to it at some stage. I think we can make important progress as Australians at that level. Australians actually do pretty well at that level, I must say. Punching above our weights, the kind of cliche, but I think it's true in many to a great extent. But I also tracked what was happening in Ningaloo all the way through and kept in touch with people, including local conservation group, Cape Conservation Group, and friends who were involved in that, and was aware of problems beginning to bubble up, and helped just in my own time behind the scenes a little bit on that. And then it just became clear that there was an opportunity to come back and help finish the job, like I was saying, and hopefully we can. And I started doing that about 4 years ago.
When people get caught up in conservation movements and look for people to philanthropically support them and the like, everyone likes to produce a sheet which says what one's successes are, so that you can always see light, small or large, at the end of the tunnel. In the WWF international periods, what were some of the major achievements?
Well, that's the thing about working internationally, as you'll know, that it's slower. Some of the ambition can be bigger, but it's slower progress. So we were trying to do things like I was saying, to try and help leaders and leading and influential institutions like The Economist and the World Economic Forum and the G20 begin to understand the importance of prioritising ocean conservation. And it's very difficult to measure that. So it was anecdotal, but we began to see, as partly as a consequence of our work, but the work of many others in around 2015, 16, 17, a bit of an uptick in the level of interest, media stories, op-eds, conferences. For those of us who have been working in ocean conservation, there's been a marked change, a material change, in the level of profile of ocean conservation in the last 6-7 years. It was almost invisible at the international level, and it's now part of the discussion. It's part of the climate discussions, it's part of the major biodiversity and broader development discussions as well. So it's hard to measure, it's hard to know what impact we had on that specifically as WWF, but I think we did have some impact and played a role in elevating that. So that's satisfying to know that we had a small part, and I had a very small part in that. What that actually leads to is another matter, but I think it's important. But it is also important to work on things that are specific to a place, particularly if you feel like you can make a difference and have an obligation almost.
It was World Oceans Day last week, 8th of June. Yes. In fact, a bunch of marine scientists locally are getting together tonight in Fremantle to talk about the very topic. Why is it that oceans are so important?
Because they provide, I mean, leaving aside the biodiversity, enormous biodiversity that we're only really just beginning to understand, scientists are just beginning to understand in many respects. But the ocean is absorbing a lot of society's ills. It's absorbing the bulk of heat that we create as a planet, enormous amounts of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, and it's changing. But it's also important for hundreds of millions of people's livelihoods and food security. So if you care about people, you have to care about the ocean. If you don't care about people so much, then there's lots of biodiversity and other things to care about, but it's increasingly understood to be a major engine room in terms of maintaining planetary health. And it's sick in many respects, we know that. And we see that with bleached coral reefs and significant degradation of coastal ecosystems, productive habitats, overfishing, things like that. We need to take action across a whole lot of levels to restore ocean health.
There's always that saying about acting locally and thinking globally. Yeah. And in some ways, I suppose from what you've said and what you now do, that's what's happened, is it? You're back protecting Ningaloo.
Exactly, and I do other things where I can with AMCS at a statewide and national level. We'll be doing more of that, and working with others. But yes, fundamentally, it's not just a cliche. You have to act locally. Even if you're acting globally a bit as well as thinking globally, everything comes down to the local ultimately. And I think it's been useful, and it is useful, I think, to have a global or a national perspective when you're working on local issues as well. You can see it through that lens. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to come back, not only because Ningaloo kind of feels personal to me. I've got three decades or so of connection or more with the area. It is personal. It's because I feel like I can potentially help, working with others can help to make a difference there, and willing to have a crack.
I can remember in the early 80s, must have been 83, 84, I was living in Canberra, teaching law, right. Went along to the High Court when they were debating the power of the Commonwealth to control the making of dams in southwest Tasmania, Paul. And the Commonwealth was found to have it. World Heritage was a big deal, yep. And it still is in Australia.
Yep.
I'm not so sure how big it is in other parts of the world. You can probably tell us. But in relation to Ningaloo, how does World Heritage fit in?
I think World Heritage is useful in that it symbolises something and kind of crystallises something. In and of itself, it doesn't necessarily make a big difference in terms of what can be allowed or not. People might be surprised to know that. But it helps instill a greater sense of pride, perhaps, in what we have. Sometimes we might be at risk of taking for granted what we have. We're so fortunate in Australia and in Western Australia. I still don't think I and others perhaps don't appreciate just how much we have here from a natural and cultural heritage perspective, both, I think. World Heritage is a way of acknowledging across culture and nature the most important places on Earth. It's very difficult to put the case that the bar is very high and getting higher for national World Heritage areas. So to achieve it, and to achieve it recently, is a big deal. And we're just sorry that we and others weren't able to extend to build enough political capital to have Exmouth Gulf included, which was recommended 20 years ago by a government committee, and then by the UN when they gazetted Ningaloo, inscribed Ningaloo. They recommended that Exmouth Gulf be included. It still hasn't. It's an open question and challenge.
And exactly then, what is the current campaign on Ningaloo?
The current campaign is to protect Exmouth Gulf, which is regarded as Ningaloo's nursery. It's an integral part of that ecosystem and important in and of itself. It's to protect it from industrialization. It's to protect it from dredging, from earth moving, from heavy infrastructure. It's an area of outstanding global significance. Enormous, hundreds and hundreds of species corals, seagrass, mangroves, algal mats, highly productive areas that make that whole system work, and lots of threatened species like dugongs and swordfish and others. It's kind of a lifeboat for lots of those kinds of animals and habitats. The last thing we should be doing is increasing pressure on it. We should be using the best available science to support economic activity like well-managed tourism, cultural tourism and science that have a small footprint, and that can be adapted over time. But blocking in ports, shipping channels, clearing huge areas for salt ponds or whatever else, and building long walls. The salt facility there would be the size of 52 King's Parks. It's hard to imagine the scale of what's being talked about for this area. It's the wrong direction as far as we're concerned. So that's we're campaigning to protect the area, to make sure that it's available for well-managed visitation and for local economic activity, but we don't think industrialisation is the right approach.
You mentioned the state government, the West Australian state government, back in the first campaign for Ningaloo, and Jeff Gallop. Who are the key decision makers when it comes to Ningaloo Part 2?
Well, as you know, we've had some recent changes in government, but the McGowan government and Mark McGowan played a really strong leadership role. And to its credit, the state government has committed to a range of protections. The EPA did an assessment of Exmouth Gulf and confirmed that it's globally important, fragile, under pressure, and needs protection. And the state government endorsed the EPA's perspective and is now sitting about creating these protected areas, etc. But it does feel like a race between this proponent-driven approach that we still see, unfortunately, in Western Australia, in the absence sometimes of adequate context and planning and science, as far as we're concerned, and protection, which can take a long time to happen. So in the interim, you have this uncertainty, which isn't good for anyone, including proponents. And that's the kind of situation that we're in now. But the federal government also has a significant responsibility because of the matters of national environmental significance right across the Exmouth Gulf and Ningaloo area. So so Minister Plibersek also has responsibility for this area.
And what's the sort of timeline for decision making or for the sort of outcomes you'd like to see?
The next months are going to be crucial. Just this week, the major salt proposal, K+S, an international salt producing company, has proposed to build this huge salt production facility at Exmouth Gulf, and so that's got a few months to run in terms of public comment and consideration. And then there's a port called Gascoyne Gateway, which will come a few months later, we think. And then there's protection mechanisms as well. So the next months are the most important for Exmouth Gulf's history in contemporary terms. It's the most important time ever for Exmouth Gulf.
I want to take you backwards.
Sure.
You've already mentioned the point to which I want to take you, where you learned something about campaigning and were able to offer yourself to the broader conservation movement as a campaigner. And that is in relation to the first fight around the Leighton Port Beach area,
yeah,
when it was proposed that there be residential apartment development there. Here's a beautiful aerial photograph of the area we're talking about, Paul, as of today. Friend Les Moyle put his drone up in the sky.
It's a great shot.
Isn't it a great shot?
Yeah.
And all of our listeners will be able to look at that straight off and know what we're now about to talk about.
Yeah.
But briefly in relation to the first campaign in that sense, over this stretch of beach and everything there and the apartments that resulted. What was the campaign then all about and what was the compromised outcome?
Yes, and the campaign was really to make sure that the coastline there would be able to withstand sea level rise and erosion. And you can imagine back in the late 90s, talking about climate change was a bit challenging for many, but not so much these days, fortunately. We were concerned that development was going to be allowed within 30 metres, about 30 metres of the vegetation, which is far too narrow an area for the dunes to be able to restore themselves and be healthy and to move from season to season and over the longer term. So we were concerned about that. We campaigned hard. It was first under the Court government, which began to take heed, to its credit, and then the Gallup government, which finished that job, Jeff Gallup and Alana McTeen in particular, to create a plan that set development back and allowed there to be a much wider coastal reserve. And so the apartments there, we weren't opposed to the apartments that are now closer to North Fremantle Station behind the Surf Life Saving Club. As far as we're concerned, for the time and given the political capital we all had at the time, that was a pretty good outcome, actually, a good compromise. And people love that area around the Orange Box and all of that. So there's also an area to the north up near the Marshalling Yards towards the McCall Centre, which is still unresolved. And there are discussions about what the future for that area could be as well. But for the most part, that campaign was successful. We've managed to have 8,000 people down at the beach there from right across the community. It was a very mainstream campaign, and that helped drive home the level of interest and help convince government that they were onto the right thing by applying good science and good policy.
I think you still see some bumper stickers around, yeah, to save later.
That's right, exactly.
When you look at this fabulous photograph by Les Moyle, and you look to the south of the Leighton Apartments, you see this, what looks like a bit of a wasteland there going down to North Quay and the port. What's happening today that has got local residents wanting to, well, in this case, probably save Port Beach?
That's right. Well, and there have been lots of studies, including by the commission by the City of Fremantle and the City of Mosman Park over the last decade or so, because of the erosion of this area. It's one of the most vulnerable areas of the whole Western Australian coastline to erosion, the Port Beach area, as people know from winter storms. There's just not enough sand coming into the area because of the way we've modified the coast. So there's more sand leaving the area than is arriving and being injected into the area. And so there's a chronic erosion trend. And when you add climate change, you've got a real problem. And so the projections are quite incredible, actually, for how much of that coastline we're going to lose in the next decades. And so there is a very rare opportunity that we think government should absolutely grasp on behalf of all of us, and particularly for future generations. While heavy industry, so it's fuel storage essentially and wool storage, etc., while those industries are moving out of the area, there's an opportunity to look at this area with fresh eyes and apply the best policy, including our very own coastal planning policy, which would see a wide area being established to be set back from the coast so the dunes can actually move in. And we buy ourselves and future generations a few more decades of life on the coast.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because there's the area of land we've identified. It's much of that's in private ownership. And there's, in a sense, under our systems, an understandable desire to develop that to its highest and best use, although highest and best use should take into account climate change.
Yeah.
There's a Metropolitan Region Scheme Amendment.
That's right.
We'll look at that in a moment. There's also the Future of Fremantle Committee, State Department.
Exactly.
Chaired by Nicole Lockwood, who I interviewed here recently in a podcast.
Yeah.
We've got all these exciting opportunities for a new urban centre, you know, transforming Fremantle. Huge deal. But the first thing is the Metropolitan Region Scheme Amendment to zone it urban deferred, and I think we're looking at a picture of that scheme amendment area, are we not?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, what we're saying is that we should be very careful, and government should be very careful not to be shackled to land uses of the past. When these land uses were allowed, no one had any real understanding of coastal processes, of course, and certainly not of climate change. And yet this amendment is following the same boundaries of yesteryear. And at a time when we know that Port Beach is too close to the coast already, the dunes are trying to move across Port Beach, right? Anyone who knows the area can see that the sand's blowing across the road. Those dunes, we're driving where the dunes should be. And our coastal planning policy and guidelines make very clear that this area must be much wider. And interestingly, and it makes sense, the coastal planning policy says we should be standing in our descendants' shoes about 100 years from now and looking at what the setback should be at that time. If you do that, it's far wider than this MRSMR amendment suggests. And so we're making the case that good policy, apart from anything else, means that you should increase that setback. But your points around the future of Fremantle are really important, as well as the fact that this area is the main beach for about 100 people from about 100 suburbs in the southern part of the metropolitan area.
And their dogs.
And their dogs. And so we have an opportunity to do something really special here. And what we're saying, apart from anything else, and the city of Fremantle is saying the same thing, actually, or very similar things to their credit, is that this is premature. At best, it's premature, because the future of Fremantle process, which includes this area we're talking about, needs to have an unfettered strategic opportunity to think about how this area could fit in with the change to the port. And this area, we just know, will become more and more valuable as the last, one of the last natural areas of coastline in this whole area.
Paul, is on this image, there's a green strip on the western side marked for parks and recreation. I understand that's what's been formally proposed by the state planning authorities. Does that not meet the bill?
It doesn't, unfortunately, because that coastline is moving. And so you can see even from the proponents' own projections that area will be largely eroded away by that chronic erosion trend and sea level rise. And so in the next decades, that area gets narrower and narrower. So the wider we can make it now, the more time we're buying for our children and their children. Otherwise, we'll end up building groins and seawalls to protect buildings. And that will not only damage and detract from that quintessential beach experience and coastal experience, which is so important in so many ways, it'll also cost an enormous amount of money, which will only get more expensive. The expenses will only grow over time as it gets narrower and narrower, and we end up defending the beach with hard infrastructure, which we know from all over the world just chews money and doesn't really do a very good job most of the time.
Well, you've been press ganged, I take it, or quite willingly, back into action over the Leighton coast, the port coast. What's your current involvement in that?
Look, it's the same core group largely, plus or minus a few people that started off in 1998 or so when I was in my 20s. It's the same core group. So I'm still there as probably the policy person and advocate, etc., whatever, dog's body, working on this with a range of other great people to try and put this case. We're just volunteers, just to put this case, because we think we know that it's consistent. We do know it's consistent with good policy, and it will help to create a healthy coastal environment for all the physical and psychological and other benefits that has for the community.
Well, there's a lovely image here, which has got lime green and almost ochre colourings on two strips of land. It says the green buffer the Leighton Action Coalition is recommending. So take us through that image.
Well, a bit like the original campaign, we see a role for well-designed, sympathetic development in these coastal areas, particularly when it's close to a train station, as this area is. So what we're saying is we think there's a real opportunity to increase the width of that coastal buffer area, that foreshore reserve, so that the dunes have more room to move. And then there will also be space behind the dunes for all sorts of recreational activity, which we see, like around the Orange Box, etc. We're just going to need much more of it. We're going to have 25,000 people also living at the port when it moves, and hundreds of thousands more people in the Southern Corridor. So this area is going to be more and more precious. And then we're saying behind that, to the east of that, there is space that could be used for well-designed development, a bit like what's already there.
That's the orange or the ochre.
To the east of the current alignment of Brack Street.
And where in the decision-making pipeline, if you like, is this debate at the moment? I'm assuming, put up an article on the Shipping News recently about the port precinct proposal. The developers, professionals are out there studying and putting proposals forward, talking to the community. They'd like, of course, to be able to do something yesterday, I suppose, but urban deferred means there'll be some delay in the decision-making process. What's your expectation? What will happen, and when will the critical points be?
Sure, it's a good question. So the Planning Commission has put out this Metropolitan Region Scheme amendment. It's a major amendment. It's a big deal for the Planning Commission, inviting comment until June 30 on this proposal, which is to and to their credit, actually, they haven't gone with urban at this moment. They're talking about urban deferred, and the deferred means subject to some further analyses, and it's based on understanding what the needs are going to be for that coastal reserve. And I and we and the City of Fremantle has expressed its views very helpfully in this respect as well, including recently, that process will be open and transparent and will take full account of the future needs of this area. If that's the case, we could get a really good outcome. I have to say I'm concerned, though, that because the Planning Commission has used the developer's preferred development envelope and footprint, we hope that they're not trying to send a signal there. They didn't have to use that line. They could have used a much more generous foreshore reserve, and they didn't. So I candidly am concerned about that, because that's all we can see. That's what they chose to put out there for public comment. We think it would have been better to actually have to look at a parks and recreational zoning across the whole area, and then to work out how much development would be appropriate for the area. From a policy perspective, and understanding that there are private interests involved, that would have been, I think, a less fettered approach.
And I assume you've made a submission to that effect?
We've made submissions over the last year or so, and are working on one for this current round as well. We've also been making our views known through the City of Fremantle, of course, and they recently agreed to take a position which is quite similar. And the reason it's all quite similar, I think, in these approaches is that it's common sense, really, and it's actually based on the state planning policy as well. So we think a lot of things are lining up to create this opportunity. And I think there are private interests, and yes, they want to monetize their ownership. I would also point out, though, that many of those interests have benefited from access to this prime land for many, many decades. And they are some very big establishments, so it would be, I think, well received by the community for them to do the right thing and reduce the pressure on government to acquiesce.
When you look back at all your campaigning over the years, starting in the original Leighton campaign, I imagine there will be some crunch points along the way, and you'll be calling on the community. What do you imagine they'll be, and how can the community help your campaign?
Yeah, look, they come in all sorts of different ways. I believe in the importance of putting the case as well as you can, and drawing on the best expertise possible, and to some extent having some degree of trust in the process. But I've also had the experience of seeing that even good intent doesn't always deliver adequately. And I've also learned that some of the things that we sometimes take for granted, including having a pretty healthy coastline for the most part, a coastline that isn't privatised, as some coastlines are in places that I've lived in the US, etc., essentially privatised. Some of these things haven't happened by accident, of course. There have been people over the decades putting the case for a better approach, and that's something I've learned, that good outcomes in the community come from a lot of ongoing work through elections, between elections, all of the time. Lots of crunch points. Sometimes you see them coming, sometimes you don't.
When local folk and others interested in this particular land use challenge go down to Port Beach, driving along Tideman Road, you see a street which cuts off called Brax Street.
Yep.
And I think if we look at Les Moyle's fantastic photograph taken from high up in the air, you can sort of see Brax Road just to the east of Port Beach Road there. Is that pretty much the line that you see on the MRS amendment for the parks and recreation?
We think that would make sense. Some people would still see that as too much of a compromise because sea level rise is going to carve up this coastline in a very big way. It's already beginning to happen. But we think that would be a reasonable outcome, and it would provide for, we hope, well-developed, well-designed development behind that line, and actually open the area up so that the community can enjoy it. It would still be a relatively tight space once you think of all the different activities that people would want to have in a coastal reserve, but it would provide us with room to move and allow those of us who believe in good strategy to have the opportunity to do something really special. It's one of the only places along our 250K or so sprawling coastline where we have this opportunity. Where else is there a land use change of this kind of scale where we could do something like this, which creates a legacy like we could?
The King's Park of the coastal area.
Exactly, something like that.
Paul, it's lovely been talking to you. You seem very sane and sensible after all of these years of conservation campaigning. What do you do to keep yourself sane and sensible away from the office?
I get into the ocean as much as I can. Just love it, like so many of us. Just love swimming, snorkeling. I windsurf. I surf extremely badly. Just all that kind of stuff. Just normal stuff like that. Love going up north. Love going to Ningaloo when I can. Not much R&R time at the moment. Rottnest down south, all of that kind of stuff. We're just so lucky to have this, which is one of the reasons that I am inspired to do this. But I'm also inspired by so many other people who feel the same way. You don't have to look too hard to find people or to ask too much of people before they'll come to the fore and help.
And those of us who live around Fremantle always perhaps take Fremantle for granted. What is it about Fremantle?
I don't know. I've lived here for 20 years or so or more, and there is something about the place that's the history in all sorts of ways. I mean, some of the history is pretty troubled as well, but there's a spirit to the place and a willingness to get involved and grapple with issues and to be a little bit mischievous and a bit cheeky, but the spirit's usually pretty positive, and there's, I don't know, there's something. You'll do a better job at articulating that than I am, I'm sure. But it keeps me here and I love it. And we missed it. My wife's from New York originally. When we've lived overseas, we really miss Frio and the friends we have and the connections. You do feel at home when you're here. And also that sense that you can actually get things done, and on a good day you can change things for the better.
Paul, it's been really lovely talking to you. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks so much. Really appreciate it.